TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The Slow Motion Execution of Julian Assange. Chris Hedges in conversation with Craig Murray. Chris Hedges is the former Middle East Bureau Chief of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and acclaimed author. Thanks to the RIA News Network for broadcasting this conversation with Craig Murray on September 15, 2023. That's a date of great importance, as the extradition of Julian Assange from Great Britain to the US might be only weeks away. Ambassador Craig Murray gives a brief overview of the legal battle and miscarriage of justice.
They're claiming that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian.
Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, was removed from his post after he made public the widespread use of torture by the Uzbek government and the CIA. He has since become one of Britain's most important human rights campaigners and a fierce advocate for Julian Assange, as well as a supporter of Scottish independence. His coverage of the trial of former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, who was acquitted of sexual assault charges, saw him charged with contempt of court and sentenced to 8 months in prison. The very dubious sentence, half of which Craig served, upended most legal norms. He was sentenced, his supporters argued, to prevent him from testifying as a witness in the Spanish criminal case against UC Global Director David Morales being prosecuted for installing a surveillance system in the Ecuadorian embassy when Julian Assange found refuge that was used to record the privileged communications between Julian and his lawyers. Morales is alleged to have carried out this surveillance on behalf of the CIA. Murray has published some of the most prescient and eloquent reports from Julian's extradition hearings and was one of a half dozen guests, including myself, invited to Julian and Stella's wedding in Belmarsh Prison in March 2022. Joining me to discuss what is happening to Julian Assange and the rapid erosion of our most basic democratic rights is Craig Murray. And just to begin, Craig, I read all of your reports from the trial, which are at once eloquent and brilliant. I think it's the best coverage or the hearings that we've had of the hearings. But I want you to bring us up to date where we are with the case at this moment.
Yeah. The legal procedures have been extraordinarily convoluted. After the first hearings, the magistrate ruled that Julian couldn't be extradited on essentially health grounds and due to the conditions in American prisons. The United States appealed against that verdict, and the High Court accepted the United States' appeal on extraordinarily dubious grounds, based on a diplomatic note giving certain assurances which were conditional and based on Julian's future behavior. And of course, the United States government has a record of breaking such assurances. And also, those assurances could have been given at the time of the initial hearing and weren't.
And I don't think those assurances have any, it was a diplomatic note, it has no legal validity.
It has no legal validity. It's not binding in any sense. And as I say, it is in itself conditional. It states that they may change this in future. It actually says that
Based on his behavior.
Based on his behavior, which they will be the sole judges of, you know, and which won't involve any further legal process. They will just decide he's going into a supermax because they don't like the way he looks at guards or something. You know, it's utterly meaningless. And as I say, the United States having won that appeal, so Julian could be extradited, it was then Julian's turn to appeal on all the points he had lost at the original extradition. And those include the First Amendment, include freedom of speech, obviously. They include the fact that the very extradition treaty under which he's being extradited states that there shall be no political extradition. And this is plainly a very political case. And several other important grounds. Nothing then happened for a year. And that appeal is an extraordinary document. You can actually find it on my website, craigmurray.org.uk. I've published the entire appeal document, and it is an amazing document. It's an incredible piece of legal argument, and some of the things it sets out, like the fact that the United States' key witness for the charges was an Icelandic guy who they paid for his evidence. They paid him for his evidence, and he is a convicted paedophile and convicted fraudster, and since he has said he lied in his evidence and he just did it for the money. That's just one example of the kind of things you find. The documentation is not dry legal documentation at all. It's well worth going and looking through Julian's appeal. That appeal ran to, I think, 150 pages plus supporting documents. For a year, nothing happened. Then, 2 or 3 months ago, it was dismissed in 3 pages of double-spaced A4, in which the judge, Judge Swift, said that there were no legal arguments, no coherent legal arguments in this 150 pages, and it followed no norm, for no known form of pleading, and it was dismissed completely. The thing is that the appeal was written by some of the greatest lawyers in the world. You know, it's supervised and written by Gareth Pearce, who is, I would say, is the greatest living human rights lawyer. Those people have seen the film In the Name of the Father, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Gareth is the lawyer, and she's played in the film by Emma Thompson. She is the lawyer who got out all those people who were framed by the British government for being members of the Irish Republican Army and terrorists, and they weren't. They were all framed. It was Gareth who got them out. She's won numerous high-profile cases. She has enormous respect all around the world. And this judge, who is nobody, he's saying there's no validity to her pleadings which follow no known form of pleading. I mean, this is quite extraordinary.
And am I correct in that he was a barrister essentially for the defense ministry? He served the interests of the UK government, and that's essentially got him his position. Is that correct?
Exactly. He was the lead barrister for the security services. Well, he was a barrister who specialized in working for the security services, and he's on record as stating that the security services were his favorite clients because they are, you know, organized and brilliant and cogent. And he's entirely a tool of the security services. And that's why he was given this particular job. You know, this is all quite extraordinary. There's almost no pretense of due process involved here, but that's been true throughout the proceedings. One of the things I witnessed during the initial extradition hearings was that when procedural motions were made, for example, on whether certain evidence was admissible, the defense would stand up and argue why the evidence should be admissible, and then the prosecution would stand up and argue why the evidence should not be admissible. And then the judge would give her ruling. But the judge came into court, and the public gallery is seated above the judge. You're higher than the judge. You can look down on the judge. And I saw 100% for certain, the judge came into court with her ruling already typed out before she heard the arguments. She sat there almost pretending to listen to what the defense was saying for an hour and what the prosecution was saying for an hour. Then she simply read out the ruling.
She'd be the Queen of Hearts. It was in Alice in Wonderland, you know, giving the verdict before she hears the sentence.
Precisely that. And my own strong suspicion is it's not the judge who wrote that ruling.
Right.
That's what she was given, you know, as this is what we want as a ruling on this one.
And just before we go on, I mean, you and I have covered, you've covered it more extensively than I have, but I've covered it and have been in London for some of the hearings. On the most basic level, the evisceration of attorney-client privilege, because UC Global recorded the meetings between Julian and his lawyers, that in a UK court, as in a US court, alone should get the trial invalidated.
Yeah, in any democracy in the world, if your intelligence services have been recording the client's attorney consultations, that would get the case thrown out. What the Americans are claiming, what the Americans claimed in court and the British government and the British judge accepted, was that the CIA, having recorded all of this material, did nothing with it. They didn't give it to anybody. They did not give it to the Justice Department, but nobody else in the American government saw it. I mean, if that were true, I should say I don't believe it for a moment, but if I were an American taxpayer, I would want to know why right. is the CIA going to enormous lengths and spending loads of money to obtain secret recordings of and then do nothing with them. How can that be true? It makes absolutely no sense, and any judge would laugh that out of court. It's like me saying that, you know, I did rob the bank around the corner, but I wasn't going to spend the money. I was just keeping it in the cupboard, so that's okay. It's completely ludicrous. And the fact that was accepted, you know, it's one of many just extraordinary rulings in this case. And it hurt me, to be honest. I had some belief in judicial system. I had some belief that in Western democracies, there is due process and there's a certain amount of fairness. I now don't believe that at all. I've absolutely, completely come to the conclusion that it's a charade and a fake, and the powers behind the scenes dictate what happens in major cases in the justice system.
You had 3 months in jail, I guess, to get that point driven onto you.
In jail to get used to it. Yeah.
But this is the last within the UK legal system, this appeal, which, as I understand, was 3 months ago. Wasn't there a 6-week deadline where they had to render a ruling within 6 weeks?
The defense had 6 weeks to submit their.
I see.
Their 20-page, and the understanding was that, you know, that meant that the thing would be done very quickly. But it's all terribly arbitrary. You know, after the first appeal was submitted, there was over a year's gap for no reason at all. And then just a 3-page response to it. You know, it doesn't take a year to write a 3-page response. And so at times it seems as though the process is for punishment. I mean, they're quite happy that they've got Julian in a maximum security prison in dreadful positions, and they're slowly killing him, in effect. And so they are in no hurry. And at times it seemed as though they're deliberately doing things as slowly as possible.
Well, this is what Niels Melzer, the special rapporteur on torture for the UN, said, that he called it a slow motion execution, I think were his words.
As you know, they put me in jail, and my own belief is that that wasn't anything to do with the articles I'd published on the trial of Alex Salmond. That was just the excuse.
Of course.
Because of my advocacy for and friendship with Julian. That's why they put me in jail, I think. And I was in a cell. My cell was 12 feet by 8 feet, which is slightly larger than Julian's cell. And I was kept in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, sometimes 23 and a half hours a day, for 4 months. And that's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult. But I knew when I was leaving, you know, yeah. I had an end date. To be in those kind of conditions as Julian is, and having for years and years, and no idea if it will ever stop. No idea if you will ever be let out alive, let alone not having an end date. I just can't imagine, you know, how psychologically crushing that would be.
Well, we heard some very disturbing testimony at the hearing about his psychological state, which, to her credit, Baritzer took into the judge.
She did.
Took into account, but calling the suicide hotline and hallucinating and banging his head against the wall. I mean, he's been 4 years now, is it, in this high security prison in London at Belmarsh, and then 7 years in the embassy.
It's amazing this is happening. You know, he's a publisher.
I know.
For goodness sake. He's not even a whistleblower
himself.
I know.
He's just unlike Ellsberg, people forget. Ellsberg took the documents.
Yeah, exactly.
Julian published them.
Yeah.
He didn't take them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And when I myself blew the whistle, the Financial Times published the information.
This is on the Black Sites.
On Black Sites, an extraordinary rendition, right. Yeah. I was fully expecting to go to jail at that stage. I thought, you know, I'm a whistleblower. I've done this for moral reasons. I'm prepared to go to jail for it. You know, I think we've got to stop this extraordinary rendition program. That means me going to jail. I'm prepared to take that. I'd have been astonished if they'd locked up the editor of the Financial Times for publishing the information. That's not how the system works. It's the whistleblower who takes the moral responsibility. This is a publisher, and you're locking him up with literally the worst terrorists in Europe who are kept in that maximum security establishment. Why? It's quite extraordinary. Look at me. I'm an old bloke who writes, and I was kept in solitary confinement for 4 months. Why? Yeah, well, what? Why do I need? Why does Julian need? Why are we such a danger that you have to be kept in the same conditions as serial killers?
Well, because you're exposing truths, very inconvenient truths, about the reality of the systems that we live under, which you're right, it's a democratic facade, but it's not democratic anymore, like the late Roman Republic. I want to talk about, so once this two-panel hearing is over, and I think it's a pretty safe assumption that they will reject the appeal, what happens then?
The immediate thing that will happen is that Julian's lawyers will try to go to the European Court in Strasbourg to... European Court of Human Rights to submit an appeal and get the extradition stopped pending an appeal. The worry is that Julian would instantly be extradited, you know, that the government wouldn't wait to hear from the European Court.
Explain to Americans what it is and what jurisdiction it has in the UK, the European Court.
Yeah. The European Court of Human Rights is not a European Union body. It's a body of the Council of Europe. And it has jurisdiction over the European Convention of Human Rights, which guarantees basic human rights. And therefore, it has legally binding jurisdiction over human rights violations in any member state of the treaty. So it does have a legally binding jurisdiction and is acknowledged as such normally by the UK government. They're very powerful voices within the current Conservative government in the UK, which wants to exit the Convention on Human Rights. But at present, that's not the case. The UK is still part of this system. And so the European Court of Human Rights has legally binding authority over the government of the United Kingdom, purely on matters that contravene human rights.
And if they do extradite him, I mean, they've essentially nullified that process. I mean, the fear is that, of course, the security services would know about the ruling in advance. He'd be on the tarmac and shuttled it, you know, sedated and put in a diaper and hooded or something and put out a CIA flight to Washington. I want to talk about if that happens. I think it's certainly very possible. What we need to do here, and I know part of the reason you're in the United States is to prepare for that should it take place. I think you will try and cover the hearings trial here as you did in the UK. But let's talk about where we go if that event occurs.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing to say is that if that happens, on the day it happens, it will be the biggest news story in the world. It will be a massive news story. So we have to be prepared. We have to know who from the Assange movement or who from his defense team, who's going to be the spokesman, who are going to be the spokespeople, who are going to be offered up to all the major news agencies, because we have to affect the story on day one. Because if you get behind the story and we know what their line will be, they'll put out all these lies about people being killed because of WikiLeaks, about the American security being endangered. We know all the propaganda that they will try to flood the airwaves with. So we need to be ready and ahead of the game to know who our people are, who are going to be offered up to interview, who are going to proactively get onto the media, and not just the alternative media like this media, but onto the mainstream media as well, so-called mainstream, and get out the story. So those things have to be taken. And then there are all the practical things, you know, the many on Julian's family, which will need to come over to support him. We'll need to know immediately how to get them, where to get them to, what their accommodation is going to be. We need activists on that day to be ready to go out and start demonstrating all over the United States. And one thing that I really believe, I've been very on this tour I'm on in the States at the moment, I've been meeting activists, and there's a huge base of very experienced and extremely impressive activists who are interested in the Assange case. But there's no real spark to it yet. I think the day he arrives, and you will have the Deadwood press, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, will be running editorials saying this shouldn't be happening. So there will be much more public awareness of what's happening and what's behind it. And I think that day, there are a lot of people ready to jump into action. Well, they have to know what to do. We have to know in each city and town in the United States where there's going to be a demonstration the day he arrives, where people should go, what time they should get there. You know, all we need to start preparing that kind of base level of activism.
I visited Julian with my friend Michael Ratner, who was Julian's lawyer since we've lost Michael a couple of years ago. But I remember, who's a great civil rights attorney, founded the Center for Constitutional Rights. But I remember Michael telling me that in order to prosecute these cases, and he got legal representation, for instance, for the prisoners in Guantanamo, you need people in the streets, that it's extremely important, and he's talking about his work in the courtroom, that there are people outside the courtroom, and you may have been in the courtroom when I was in London with Baritzer complaining at one point, the judge, about the noise outside the courtroom.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. We're going to need to have people at the actual court itself. And there'll be all kinds of procedural steps of Julian being produced and not produced and all kinds of motions filed and things before the court itself gets the trial proper, gets going. But at each stage, it's very important to have people available and at the courtroom and able to go outside.
What about the argument that Biden doesn't want to deal with this? Well, he's a very close election. He's kind of neck and neck with Trump. And then let's also talk about the speculation that there might be a plea deal and he could go to Australia. He's an Australian citizen, of course.
Well, firstly, I sometimes really wonder whether the United States government realizes how it looks to the outside world. You know, here you have a government whose main political opponent, and I'm no fan of Donald Trump, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but he is their main political opponent. And they're trying to put him in prison so he can't fight in an election. Now, how does that look to the rest of the world? What are you constantly accusing Russia of doing? What are you constantly accusing all kinds of other nations of doing? You know, how does that affect US standing? We've got a presidential election coming, so the guy who's ahead in the polls, let's put him in jail so he can't stand. You know, that's, and if at the same time you're doing that, you're also trying to put the most famous publisher in the world in jail simultaneously, What message is that sending out to the world? You know, that's sending out the message to the world that you are a completely fake democracy and that your human rights record is actually no better than that of China or Russia or any of these other countries you are constantly criticizing. So I think the Biden administration would be completely mad to bring Julian here, to extradite Julian. You know, I don't understand why they don't see the danger in what they are doing in terms of freedom of speech worldwide and people's opinion to repression and censorship worldwide.
I think because it's driven by the CIA. I think the CIA with Vault 7, which exposed the hacking tools that the CIA has put into our phones, our televisions, even our cars. And that, of course, is when Trump announced the extradition. And before, President Obama had used the Espionage Act against whistleblowers, but he hadn't used it against journalists. Trump up the ante by calling for the use of the Espionage Act to extradite, in this sense, a journalist. But my reading of it is that it they don't care how they look. And part of it is to send a message. It doesn't matter what nationality you are. It doesn't matter where you are. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. It doesn't matter where you are. If you expose the kind of information that Julian and WikiLeaks exposed, we're going to come for you. Isn't that the message?
I think that's absolutely right. And this, again, it's amazing they don't see the dangers in this claim of universal jurisdiction. The United States isn't going to be the most powerful country in the world for much longer. It already isn't. But you know, China is growing stronger and stronger. What are they going to say when the Chinese start plucking away American journalists for having published something rude about China, even though they've never been to China? You know, and this claim of universal jurisdiction is extraordinary. And what's even more extraordinary is they're claiming universal jurisdiction, that Julian is under their jurisdiction because he published American secrets, even though he's not an American and he wasn't in America. And at the same time, while they claim jurisdiction over him, they're claiming he has no First Amendment rights because he's an Australian. Now, that's the combination of that okay, we have jurisdiction over you. You have all the liabilities that come with that, but you have none of the rights that come with that because you're not one of our citizens. That, you know, that's pernicious. It's so illogical and so vicious. I actually didn't believe it. I thought this was just Pompeo mouthing off until there was a recent Supreme Court judgment about 2 years ago in a case of U.S. aid against overseas development agencies, where it said essentially that the people abroad in receipt of U.S. aid don't have First Amendment rights and can be gagged from saying certain things as a condition of aid because they're not U.S. citizens. And if you read the judgment specifically says we cannot accord First Amendment rights to non-U.S. citizens because otherwise it would have to apply to overseas citizens handled by the U.S. military. So what they're saying is if Julian has First Amendment rights, then people in Guantanamo Bay have rights. So no one has
I just want to close because there's been noises out of Australia. The ambassador, Carolyn Kennedy, said that they, you know, might consider a plea deal. I have put no credence in it. I think it's all smoke, but I wondered what you thought.
Yeah, I think it's an attempt to placate Australian public opinion. Public opinion in Australia is extremely strong. You know, over 80% of Australians want Julian released and allowed to go home to Australia. And Blinken came there and made some very hostile and undiplomatic remarks at a time Australia was allowing the United States to base nuclear weapons on its side. So I think Caroline Kennedy came out of this. I think it's a lie, frankly. There has been no approach from the Justice Department or from the State Department offering any kind of plea deal. It's purely smoke and mirrors to try to distract the Australian public. Caroline Kennedy was lying to the Australian public. That's pure and simple.
Great, thanks. That was Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and one of the great champions of Julian Assange. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granadino, Adam Coley, David Hebden, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.
And my thanks go out to all. Chris Hedges, former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times and war reporter, and acclaimed author, most recently of The Greatest Evil is War. Craig Murray was the British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was removed from his post after he made public the use of torture by the Uzbek government and the CIA. He now is one of Britain's most important human rights campaigners. And many thanks to the Real News Network. You can find this conversation on YouTube under the title The Slow Motion Execution of Julian Assange. All need and deserve our attention and support.
You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.